This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm really delighted to have in the studio with me Michael Stephen Smith, the lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights, one of the great civil liberties groups in the country, and co-author of Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. Michael Stephen Smith, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt. It's nice to be here, even in the snow.
Well, it's great to have you here. And I noticed that this is the second book you've written with Michael Ratner, also of the Center for Constitutional Rights, on Che. Why is Che so interesting to you?
Well, he was assassinated, which is a political murder, back in 1967. And until our book came out, the common understanding was that the United States didn't do it, that it was done by the Bolivian dictatorship. And that's just not true. This murder was organized right out of the White House.
You know, a lot of us on the left have suspected that for a long time, but, you know, you've got the documents to prove it, or at least to make a very strong case.
105 pages. We printed the documents in the book, and then we put them in historical context. Two of the smoking guns are, one, written on White House stationery by Walt Whitman Rostow, Johnson's chief of counter-revolution, if you will. They had an office, the National Security Office, in the White House. His job was to monitor and suppress revolutionary movements around the world. Walt Whitman Rostow, his brother was Eugene Victor Debs Rostow. His parents were radicals. They must have been disappointed. Rostow writes to Johnson, and he says, "The troops that we supplied and trained, quote, finally got him." The document's in the book. The other smoking gun is an interview that the Mexican diplomat and historian Jorge Castaneda did with Gustavo Villaldo. Villaldo was the chief CIA guy in Bolivia at the time. Villaldo reports that when he got off the plane in La Paz, he went directly to the palace where he spoke with Barrientos, the general, the dictator, the head of Bolivia. And he said to Barrientos, "Look, we'll help you, but if you catch him, we want him killed." And Barrientos said, "You have my word as the president of Bolivia that if we catch him, we will kill him."
And that's what happened, of course. And you know, there's also, you have a document in there from Rostow who says to Johnson after the fact that, you know, this is one way of ending the fascination that people have with romantic revolutionaries, how wrong he was, because the fascination with Che is about the most romantic figure there is on the left still internationally.
It's so fantastic. You know, I was watching the events unfold in Tahrir Square, and there were people wearing Che T-shirts. And then you get over to Madison, and right in the state capitol, there are people wearing Che T-shirts. And the people in Egypt are sending pizzas to the people in Madison, they're calling them occupies. And then the occupation movement started up in New York, where I'm from, and they're still wearing Che T-shirts. He is the icon, not only of somebody who talked about social change, but somebody that tried to do something for it.
And is it the fact that he was a martyr of the cause that has made him so romantic, or was he romantic beforehand?
I think both. He has wonderful stories about Che growing up. You know, he was the oldest son, five children, born to an aristocratic Argentinian family that had more blue blood than money. His parents were bohemians. His mom didn't get married until she was 3 months pregnant. This is back in 1928. It must have been quite a scandal. They lived in a kind of a Catholic conservative neighborhood. His parents were anti-clerical. They ran a bohemian household. There were no fixed meal times. The kids rode their bikes in the front door, through the living room, and out the back door.
So they were hippies before their day.
They sure were. Their furniture was piled with books and magazines. People came in to smoke cigarettes and drink red wine and talk politics all afternoon and night. Che read voraciously. He read Bertrand Russell, Aldous Huxley, Jack London. He read Freud. He read Marx. He wrote an article about Marx. He read Lenin. He said, "I love Lenin because he eats, dreams, and sleeps revolution." He organized a soccer team. They organized the team amongst all his atheist friends. The whole team were children that didn't believe in God, and they invariably lost because the other teams had more members.
Now, why did he become a doctor then? Because I saw that fascination he had with Marx and Lenin and revolution early on, and then to go to a traditional field like medicine seemed odd.
His main interest then, he wasn't that political, actually, and he didn't get so until later on, and I'll tell you about that in a moment. But the reason why he became a doctor is he said they wanted to be a research doctor and discover something that would be useful for humankind, like the cure to TB. He worked in a leper colony. Before he graduated medical school, he shipped out as a merchant mariner and rubbed shoulders with a lot of different kind of people. And then he took that famous motorcycle trip. You saw the movie, right? The Motorcycle Diaries. And he kept the diary of the trip. He went to Chile, where they saw the copper mines. And he went to Bolivia, where he saw the tin mines. And he wrote in his diary, "The Yankees have taken everything and left the people only an ox." Got back home to Buenos Aires, studied and passed 10 medical school exams in 10 weeks.
And was it hard to get into medical school and pass those tests back then? I mean, it's hard now. I imagine it was hard then.
It was hard then. And to pass 10 tests in 10 weeks.
That's a lot of hoops.
Sartre called Che the most complete man of the 20th century. Oh, he was extraordinary. He was a poet, a good athlete, a magnificent soldier, a doctor. But he tried to get a job in Guatemala in 54 as a doctor. He was there for 11 months, never got a job, worked as a photojournalist, a good photographer.
What was he doing in Guatemala?
Well, he was looking for work as a physician. And the president of Guatemala was reform president, Jacobo Arbenz.
He didn't go there to be there with the socialist
He went there. Well, he wanted to be in a progressive country, but he wanted to be a doctor. And couldn't get a job. And then Arbenz made the mistake of nationalizing some fallow land that was unused and gave it to peasants so that the people that worked the land could actually use it. And the land belonged to United Fruit, Chiquita Banana, whose attorney had been Alan Dulles, who was the head of the CIA. So the Arbenz government was quickly overthrown. The CIA organized a counter-revolution based in Nicaragua, trained the troops, brought them into Guatemala. They overthrew the government. Che tried to resist it to no avail, wound up hiding out in the Argentinian embassy, and then went to Mexico City. And this is an interesting story because one of the people that he had known in Guatemala, Nico Lopez, was a veteran of the attack on the Mikado barracks in Cuba when they tried to take over the second largest barracks in Cuba under the big Batista dictatorship. And Lopez was in Mexico City too. So he said to Che, "I want you to meet a friend of mine. He just got into town. His name is Fidel Castro." They had dinner that night. Che reports in his diary that there was an instant sympathy between the two of them. He said Castro was just extraordinary, a man of great will, that he knew that if he said that he would go to Cuba to fight, that he would, and that if he said he was going to fight, that he would win, and if he said he was going to try to establish a decent kind of society in Cuba, that he would. And so Che signed on as the troop doctor. He was the third one. Raul, Fidel's younger brother, was the second, and they trained under the leadership of a general named Alberto Bayo, who had fought in the Spanish Civil War and left after Franco was successful, came to Mexico, trained the men. 82 of them set out on a little boat called the Granma that Castro had bought. He bought it from a Texan who had named the boat Granma after his grandmother. And they took the boat from Mexico to Cuba. They got there a day late. They landed in the wrong place. They landed in the middle of a mangrove swamp, which is impossible to tread through. Batista was forewarned that they were coming. They came under a hail of bullets. Of the 82 men, only 20 survived.
And Che was wounded, right?
Slightly. Mm-hmm. And he was faced with the choice of grabbing his ammunition bag or his medical bag. And he grabbed his medical bag, and then he dropped it, and he grabbed the ammunition bag, and he headed into the Sierra Maestra Mountains. And he soon proved to be a great soldier. He was Fidel's chief confidant and really second in command. And he and Camilo Cienfuegos led the column that captured Santa Clara 2.5 years later. They captured a troop train with all kinds of ammunition on it. They cut the island in half. They were rearmed. All the peasantry that supported them were then very well armed. Batista got the message and split. Went to the Dominican Republic, and the revolutionaries marched into Havana 8 days later. They went over to the Hilton Hotel, which they renamed the Havana Libre. That was their headquarters. The first thing they did was pass a law that made it possible for Fidel to be the premier because he was too young. So they made the law. He was 33 years old. Che was 32. The second law was to make Che a citizen of Cuba. The third law was the great agrarian reform law that Che helped write. And that gave the land to these huge estates, mostly owned by American corporations, to the peasants who farmed it. And the lesson they learned in Guatemala was this, that you give the land to the peasants and you arm them so they can defend their conquest. And you dismantle the old ruling apparatus or it'll come back to bite you. And that's exactly what they did. This scared the pants off the United States, which had been trying to defeat Castro even before, while Batista was still the dictator. And what did the United States do? They refused, because they owned the oil refineries, to refine oil. So there was no gasoline. So the Cubans couldn't run the country. So the Cubans nationalized the oil refineries. Then they nationalized the phone company. Then they nationalized the nickel plants. Then they nationalized more land. And this willy-nilly became kind of as a defensive reaction, the socialist revolution in Cuba. And in essence, the 99% became the 1%, and the 1% went to Miami.
I'm speaking with Michael Stephen Smith. He's with the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he's the co-author of this book we're talking about today, Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. One rap against Che that I've read in reviews of some of those biographies that have come out is that when he was heading up or helping Fidel head up the military, that he, you know, assassinated people too. Do you have any take on that? Or took prisoners and killed them when they were captives?
I think that's true. I think it happened several times. We're not talking about a pajama party here. We're talking about war, and you use harsh measures in war. Revolutions are no picnic. Hard things happen. Che was a hard guy. There's those romantic photographs of him, but he was first and foremost a soldier.
Now, there was some talk about when he was leaving Cuba that he had had some falling out with Fidel, but you assert in this book that actually that wasn't true.
That's CIA misinformation, something we're used to. Absolutely not true at all. In fact, a condition that Che laid down when he signed up to join the movement of the Cubans was that he may not, he said, I don't want to be detained by reasons of state from leaving because my mission is going to be elsewhere, particularly Argentina. And the Soviet Union, when they found out that Che was in Bolivia, irate, Kosygin, the premier, actually flew to Cuba and confronted Castro and said, why haven't you told me? And Castro, she said, this is going to upset our plans for socialism in Latin America. And Castro said, we didn't tell you because it's none of your business. Latin Americans have every right to fight for their own freedom without your knowing about it. And moreover, I don't grant your premise. I don't think you're looking to fight for revolution anywhere. The only time you help movements is when they help your own cause. So I don't even grant your premise. There was no split with Fidel. They were very close. Che's funeral, Fidel spoke very movingly about Che and said that I loved him.
Why was the Communist Party or the Soviet Union not interested in supporting armed struggle in Latin America at that point?
Well, they weren't interested. They were not internationalists. By the time of the Cuban Revolution in 59, and I would argue going back even 30 years before that, they're developed in the wake of the Russian Revolution because of hardships in Russia, a whole privileged bureaucratic caste in Russia. When Che went to Russia, he was shocked. He saw all these dudes walking around with fur coats and fur hats and living in expensive dakas in the country as their second homes and the kind of lavish meals they would have. He thought, what the hell kind of socialism is this? But it was that kind of material privilege that these guys in the Soviet bureaucracy were trying to defend, and they did it by making deals with imperialism, and they did it under the mantra of peaceful coexistence. You know, you don't rock our boat and we won't rock yours.
So Che originally went, when he left Cuba, he went to Africa at one point.
He tried to help the Congolese. You'll remember Patrice Lumumba, the nationalist head of the movement in the Congo, was assassinated with the help of the CIA. A CIA agent drove around with Lumumba's body in his trunk for 3 days. And Che went there to try to revive the movement. It was really beyond revival. He was there for several months, couldn't do much, and had to leave defeated.
And was he helping out in other areas in Africa, too?
No. The Cubans did subsequently, of course. Right. If it wasn't for the Cubans' intervention, I don't think the South Africans would have made it. But no, Che had long-standing plans, actually, to go to Bolivia. When he was in East Germany in 1962, he met Tanya, the famous woman revolutionary Tamar Bunke, and said, if you want to help, you go to La Paz and start developing an underground network and get us some false documents. And she went. She got there 2 years before he did. His plans, and he had discussed this with Fidel, he had a long time set his sights on Bolivia. Why? Because Bolivia was the most unstable government in all of Latin America. It had had, since 1825, 189 different governments. It had a democratic government under Paz, up until from 1950 to 1964, and then the CIA overthrew Paz. The CIA overthrew any country in Latin America or the Caribbean that refused to isolate Cuba. Brazil went down, the Dominican Republic went down, Chile, obviously, with Allende. Any country that wouldn't play ball with the United States and put an economic freeze and trade embargo on Cuba and not recognize them diplomatically, they overthrew all those governments. Mm-hmm. Che went to Bolivia in essence, really, to defend the gains of the Cuban Revolution by extending them, because they were being encircled and crushed.
I'm intrigued by Tanya. Tell me a little bit about Tanya.
Well, her parents were radicals. Her mother was Jewish. She was a philosophy student in East Berlin. She met Che when he came there and gave a speech, and was immediately drawn towards trying to help the movement that he exemplified. She went and changed her name and lived a different life in La Paz for 4 years, and rubbed shoulders with the upper crust in Bolivia, and was able to procure false documents for her comrades, played a very useful role. She made the mistake, and it was against Che's wishes. She drove her Jeep into Che's camp in the jungle, and the Jeep was discovered, her identity was discovered, so she couldn't go back. And she joined the group then, and the group was cut in half intentionally, because they were training, so they split up in two. But the half that Tanya was in, they never caught up with Che, and they were eventually betrayed by somebody for money. And the Bolivian Rangers that the CIA and the American Special Forces, the Green Berets, were training, they were tipped off to where they were going to cross the river, and they were all murdered when they were trying to cross the river, including Tanya.
Now, he had some problems there. I mean, it didn't catch on. His revolution didn't catch on in Bolivia. And you quote his diaries extensively, and he keeps saying, you know, we're not getting support from the peasants here, and we're isolated here, and we need to get out of here and get to a safer spot. And so why wasn't he getting more support?
They never got out of there. Their plan was, when they landed in November of 66, to train for 4 months and then go up north. And they never got there. They were discovered right away in March, and in April it was discovered that Che was the leader of them, and American generals started furiously flying down to Bolivia. The head of the Southern Command, Tope, came down. Another intelligence guy came down. The head of the Air Force came down. They set up this special outfit out of the White House to track them and capture them. The head of the Southern Command signed a contract with the Bolivian government called a Memorandum of Understanding, and the deal was this. The Bolivians supplied the men and the place, and the United States supplied everything else, from bullets to breakfast. They gave them everything they needed, helicopters, guns, everything. And they trained. They had 16 Special Force guys from the Green Beret come in and train this ill-equipped, demoralized Bolivian army. They trained them up pretty well. They had no intelligence, however. The intelligence services, the Bolivian army, had been destroyed with the Bolivian revolution 12 years before. So the CIA provided the intelligence. They sent in two guys, and they dressed them up as captains in the Bolivian army. One guy was this Gustavo Villaldo, who I told you about, the son of one of the richest men in Cuba before the revolution. His father owned a General Motors assembly plant and a farm of 100,000 acres.
Oh.
And the other guy was Felix Rodriguez, who's infamous. He was a friend of George Bush's, actually. He wound up in the Iran-Contra scandal, and he was in Nicaragua. But Rodriguez was also wealthy, lived on the waterfront in Havana. His uncle, who he lived with, was the minister of public works in Cuba. Rodriguez, when he graduated high school, his folks gave him an expensive Austin Healey sports car. He spent the summer driving around chasing girls in Miami, and then he joined the counter-revolution Cubans. Real man of honor, he said. He wanted to kill Fidel Castro, tried to assassinate Fidel. He was asked at a congressional hearing, "Isn't it true, Mr. Rodriguez, that you tried to kill Fidel Castro with an exploding cigar?" And Rodriguez said, "No, that's not true. Actually, I tried to kill the son of a bitch with a telescopic rifle." And these were the two guys that headed up intelligence for the CIA. It was Rodriguez that actually identified where Che was and called in the Bolivian Rangers, who surrounded Che, shot his gun out from under him, wounded him in the leg, captured him, and took him over to this little mud schoolhouse in La Higuera for 2 days before he was assassinated.
I'm speaking with Michael Stephen Smith with the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's the co-author with Michael Ratner, his colleague there, of a book called Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Now, Rodriguez was there when he was killed, right?
Rodriguez claims that he used American shortwave radio to crank it up and called into La Paz, and they had a arranged code. 05 meant Che, 06 meant keep him alive, 07 meant kill him. And Rodriguez called in, got a hold of one of the generals in La Paz, and he got the code back, 0507. And he said, "Well, I knew that my government didn't want him killed, but there's really nothing I could do about it. And I just transmitted the code 0507, and they went in and killed him." The story of Che's death is as follows. The lieutenant who was picked to shoot Che got cold feet. So they went out and they drew straws amongst a number of sergeants. And the sergeant that drew the shortest straw was a man named Mario Terran. Terran went in. Che was sitting down with his hands bound in front of him. He looked at Terran. He knew what was going to happen. And he stood up. And Terran said, "Sit down." And Che said, "I know what you're here for." And Terran said, "You're mistaken." And then Terran lost his nerve, and he went back outside, had a couple of drinks, came back in. Che stood up again. Terran said, "Sit down." Che said, "I will remain standing for this." Terran closed his eyes, squeezed off a number of shots, sprayed Che in the chest with the bullets. His lungs filled up with blood, and he died. Whereupon Rodriguez and Gustavo Villaldo took his corpse outside, tied it on the struts of an American helicopter, rode in the helicopter to the bigger village of Valle Grande, where they took his body into the basement of the hospital and laid it out on a concrete slab so that they could have a press conference and photographers could come. You've seen that famous picture, Matt, of photographers come take pictures of his corpse. That was a mistake. And then when the press conference was over, they cut his hands off and they shipped his hands to Langley, Virginia, to the headquarters of the CIA. And there they identified the fingerprints because they had kept copies of his fingerprints from the first time he was in Miami in 1952 and other times. And Walt Whitman Rostow writes a memo to Johnson on White House stationery, which we include in our book, saying, "We finally got him. The body's been identified."
I'm talking with Michael Stephen Smith about his book, Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. You also published documents in here that demonstrate a kind of a cover-up, that the U.S. officials were blowing smoke to cover their tracks here. One U.S. official says, you know, they killed Che and that was stupid, and that's in a formal document. And there are other things that seem like they're just playing this game of plausible deniability.
Plausible deniability is a great Orwellian term, isn't it? It came into being in 1948, In 1947, the CIA was formed pursuant to the National Security Act, and it was formed to be an intelligence gathering operation for the White House, for the president, because they were caught sleeping when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and they formed the CIA so that wouldn't happen again. But a year after they were formed, George Kennan, the father of the Cold War, wrote National Security Memo Number 10, and that set up the CIA as a paramilitary organization. Of course, the stuff they were told to do was illegal, so they had to have plausible deniability. They couldn't really say that the president wanted this done. In fact, Richard Helms, who was the chief of operations when Che was killed and later became the head of the CIA, the man who knew all the secrets, Richard Helms testified before the Church Committee in 1975 in those famous hearings when they asked him about all these assassinations that the CIA had been doing. And he was asked, well, did you ever tell the president? And he said, never. He said, we wouldn't tell the president. We didn't want to embarrass him. But they got the broad outlines from the president, and then they were given the leeway and the flexibility to go do what they had to do.
Yeah, the interpretation of that isn't that it was a kind of a rogue agency or that there were rogue agents, but the president wanted them to do this and just didn't want his fingerprints all over it.
Well said.
And now some people who've written books about Che, they continue the story or the claim that, you know, the U.S. wasn't involved, or the CIA didn't do it. What do you make of that?
Well, there were three major biographies that came out about 10 years ago. And then there was another one that a lot of people haven't read, written by a State Department official, Fox Butterfield Ryan. Quite a good book, and we relied on it a lot. He had friends in both the House and the Senate and got a lot of the documents we used. And Ryan admired Che, and he thought that the White House was deeply involved in capturing him. But at the last minute, it wasn't the White House that assassinated him. He said they knew about it, and they were morally responsible for it, like Pontius Pilate, but they didn't actually do it. But with all the information that we were able to gather, including those of Ryan, we took it one step further. It's clear to us if you contextualize it. I mean, they tried to kill Che before. They got this gangster out of Chicago, Johnny Rosselli, the partner of Sam Giancana, and they got some poison pills. It was like right out of James Bond, you know.
This is while he was in Cuba.
Yeah. And the guy that was supposed to deliver the pills into Che's food got cold feet. They tried to kill Fidel 602 times. That's been documented. There was a campaign that went on against the Cuban Revolution from before it even happened. Ricardo Alarcón, the president of the Cuban National Assembly, wrote the introduction to our book. And he documents what the United States did in terms of training and supplying Batista's troops before the Cuban Revolution. 20,000 people were killed. In Bolivia, for example, 20 out of the 23 top military people in the Bolivian military were trained by the CIA. Mm. The police force was trained by the CIA. They had their hands all over it. You got to be really naive to think that they'd back off from their project at the last minute. Read the book. It's documented there. You may then make up your own mind.
And the book is called Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. The author, my guest this week, has been Michael Stephen Smith. He works at the Center for Constitutional Rights, as does his co-author, Michael Ratner. And is there a website people can go to find something out about this?
Well, sure. It's published by Orr Books, O-R, Orr Books. You can get it through Orr Books. And we have a radio show, too, as you know, Matt. It's called Law and Disorder. And you can get our show on lawanddisorder.org. And
we're just about out of time, though. And you can find out more about it, too, at just Googling Center for Constitutional Rights or the author here, Michael Stephen Smith. Unfortunately, we're out of time.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.